There's an observational bias known as the streetlight effect that impacts everything from medical research to astronomy to police investigations. Here, Panorama Software provides the most common illustration of the effect.
What is the streetlight effect? This is when you look for something only by checking the most obvious places. The search itself is sometimes called the drunkard's search, taken from an old joke that goes like this. A policeman sees a drunk man searching for something under a streetlight and asks the drunk what he's lost. The drunk says, "I lost my keys," and they both look under the streetlight together. After a few minutes, the policeman asks if he's sure he lost them here. The drunk replies, "No, I lost them in the park." The policeman asks, "Why are you searching here then?" The drunk replies, "This is where the light is."
The illustration is simple to explain. Like the drunk looking for his keys, a police officer looks for a suspect in the easiest place. And then, having found one, confirmation bias kicks in, leading the officer and later the state to ignore evidence that conflicts with their theory of guilt. And in turn, this leads to wrongful convictions, especially wrongful convictions of black men. While only about 13% of this country's population is African American, about 47% of its exonerees are African American, and the vast majority of them are men. This is the story of one of those black men, Jonathan Irons, and his case is a perfect illustration of the streetlight effect. A homeowner in what was described as a white flight suburb of St. Louis was shot during a botched burglary by a young black man. Jonathan Irons was a young black man who stuck out like a sore thumb on the night of the burglary to some of the residents of the man's neighborhood, some of whom saw him with a gun. And so, as the streetlight effect would suggest, Irons soon became the prime suspect. And as confirmation bias would suggest, when the case was presented to jurors in the show-me state, they were only shown the evidence of his guilt. But there is so much more to his case that jurors didn't see, and we will present it on this season of Undisclosed.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the state versus Jonathan Irons. This is the first episode in a 4-episode series about a young man who has been in prison since he was 16 years old, and yet who might be on the brink of regaining his freedom. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts and colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson, I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller, I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Jonathan Irons' story takes us back to the night of January 14, 1997, in the St. Louis suburb of O'Fallon, which was recently in the news as one of the cities where police officers marched with protesters in the wake of the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. Here's a clip from the television station KSDK.
Protesters are walking up Mexico Road, heading to Bryan Road. Many are chanting Black Lives Matter and George Floyd.
I'm going to be part of the solution instead of sitting back.
It's important for us to be out here and be showing everybody, hey, it's here and it affects me.
At the front of the pack, officers including O'Fallon Police Chief were arm in arm with the teenagers. Their worlds interlocked in this moment.
23 and a half years before this march, Jonathan Irons was in the same spot as these protesters, at the corner of Mexico and Bryan Roads in O'Fallon for the day that would change his life. Here's what the jury would be told about that day. Around 5 p.m., two of Jonathan Irons' new friends saw him in the Osage Meadows neighborhood just southwest of the intersection of Mexico and Bryan. He had a gun and a couple of CDs that they played. Later, at about 6 p.m., another of Irons' friends in Osage Meadows saw Irons holding a plastic bag. Irons got the friend to knock on the door of his neighbor, which is where Irons' ex-girlfriend and her disapproving parents lived. Finally, at 6:42 p.m., a resident of one of the homes in the neighborhood called 911, saying that he'd been shot twice by a young black man hiding in his house. The police then arrived minutes later and found a broken window leading to the basement of the house, and next to it was a plastic bag containing a portable CD player and a case with a dozen CDs. Sounds pretty open and shut, right? But let's dig deeper than the state's case, and let's start with Jonathan Irons explaining how he ended up in Osage Meadows that night. First, we'll start with his childhood. Jonathan was born to an absent father and a mother plagued by mental illness. As a result, he was raised by his great aunt, whom he calls his grandmother.
So your grandmother takes you in very soon after you're born, right?
Yeah, and actually, she's actually not even my grandmother. She's my great aunt, but I call her Granny, and you know, I identify her as my grandmother. So, she not only she took in me, she took in multiple other relatives and, you know, children in the family. She was pretty much the backbone of our family.
What exactly is the familial situation you have growing up?
Well, we were born and raised into poverty. Unfortunate set of circumstances, but when I was young, growing up, when I was really young, I really wasn't aware of it because, you know, my grandmother did a good job of smothering us with love and games and fun. But, you know, the older I got, the more aware of it I became. You know, just going to visit friends' houses and noticing that the houses were different than mine and their living conditions were different than mine. It was interesting. I spent a lot of time riding my bike and, you know, playing sports and, you know, running around through the woods. I can say that, you know, growing up, my childhood was as normal as my grandmother could manage under the circumstances. But it was tough, but, you know, I made it.
I then followed up with Jonathan on the differences he noticed between his house and his friends' houses. And when you say you would go to other people's houses and see the different living conditions, what were the living conditions you had growing up?
Well, some specific things were, I noticed that, you know, my friends had toilets and bathtubs, and, you know, we used to go to the bathroom in a 5-gallon bucket and, you know, take baths in those tin tubs that we used to bathe the dogs in. You know, those are rough. We had an unfinished bathroom and it was pretty much a storage area. We had a tub in there and other stuff, but it, you know, it wasn't set up or functioning. It was still in boxes and there was other stuff in there. And that was rough to see that. And then I had friends that would want to come over and visit, and I was embarrassed to let them come in because of that.
Right.
Just our house was, you know, it was pretty bad shape. The foundations were cracked, and it really wasn't finished. But it was a home. It was a roof over our head, though.
And then there was school. Jonathan's memory of his education is consistent with his reputation as high energy and short attention span in a school system that was ill-equipped to deal with him back in 1997. How is school for you growing up? What do you feel like, and what do you experience in the education system?
Well, I loved being around my friends, and I enjoyed school, but, you know, I had some teachers that didn't cared for my energy. I was, you know, I was a very, you know, hyperactive kid. I was always moving around, jumping, moving, wanted to do stuff. You know, when other kids were sitting down, you know, I had a tendency to, you know, want to get up. I'd finish my work or didn't finish my work, and I'd be up moving and grooving, and, you know, just couldn't sit still. I just had a lot of energy. So a lot of teachers were frustrated with that, and, you know, I don't necessarily think it's their fault or anything. It's just maybe not knowing how to handle a child with that much energy. So, but, and, you know, they, the way they handled it, they, you know, they disciplined me, and, you know, and I developed resentments toward some of those teachers, and, you know, kind of lost over time interest in, you know, in learning in school.
Right. And eventually that leads to you dropping out, right?
Yeah. I saw friends and relatives that were, you know, that were not in school, and, you know, and I felt like every time I hung out with them, you know, I had fun and I liked the way they lived, and school just became, you know, a pain, and I really regret that the decision to, you know, to drop out, because that was bad. But, you know, the reality of it is, you know, I did, and
And so, after dropping out of school, Jonathan found himself in the heart of what's known as the exclusion cycle, as an undereducated black male in a society of discrimination and lack of opportunity, forced to come up with survival strategies. And for Jonathan, the most readily available survival strategy was selling weed.
I was selling marijuana for, a relative of mine. And I just started just to continue to do that, and, trying to mimic their moves and, follow their advice and continue to just, stack my money, and I would give it to this particular relative, and he would hold some of my money, and then if I needed something, he would, help me obtain it, and, just basically supported myself off of that, off of selling marijuana.
And while Jonathan regrets his decision today, it's what took him to Osage Meadows on January 14th, 1997. Jonathan had some friends in the mostly white neighborhood of Osage Meadows, which was in the mostly white city of O'Fallon. And Jonathan would sometimes sell weed to the residents, which is what he was doing there on the 14th.
If I can take you then to January 14th, 1997, this is the day of the incident at the Stotler House. I know it's been a number of decades now, but what do you remember about that day?
I kind of do, but I don't. Just normal day. I hung out in the neighborhood and visited friends, and and I sold joints and the bags of marijuana to friends and people that I knew in the neighborhood, and I just hung out there, it didn't really stand out to me, and until after. I was, arrested and I just continued to try to rack my brain and figure out what is significant about this day. And to this day, I still don't, I have all the details and, remember everything.
But while it's been 23 years for Jonathan Irons, essentially all of the residents of Osage Meadows were interviewed on the night of January 14th, 1997, or early the next morning. And we can use their statements to track his movements. Let's start at 1333 Buffalo Rock Drive. Buffalo Rock Drive is an east-west street towards the north of the Osage Meadows neighborhood, which is laid out on a grid.
Predominantly white neighborhood, pretty clean houses. And, basically, they were kind of stacked on top of each other, meaning they were in close proximity. The yards were, all of them were fenced in for the most part. It's rare you would see a house that didn't have a fence behind it or in between houses. I had a number of friends there. Had blocks, and it was pretty clean subdivision.
According to Carrie Scarlett, her fiancé and her brother Larry were working on the family car at 1333 Buffalo Rock Drive when Jonathan Irons came by at about 5 o'clock p.m. This lines up with Jonathan's claim that he was dropped off in Osage Meadows shortly before 5 o'clock that day by his friend Charles Ruby. Carrie Scarlett gave a description of Jonathan's clothes that was similar to the description given by most other witnesses. She said he was wearing a gray checkered sweatshirt, a dark jacket, and dark pants. According to Carrie's brother Larry, he was working underneath the family car when Jonathan gave him a light kick to get his attention, followed by the two talking for a minute. Larry says that Jonathan then went one door to the west, to 1337 Buffalo Rock Drive, where his friend Tim Russell lived. Both Tim Russell and Jonathan's friend Aaron Windau would give police statements that Jonathan came to Tim's house on the 14th and displayed a gun that Jonathan said he'd been able to wrestle away from a hippie-looking guy who had pulled it on him during a drug deal a couple weeks ago at a gas station. Jonathan still has a vivid memory of this encounter today.
Yeah, it was a gas station that was in Winsfield by my grandmother's house, and I was gonna sell him some marijuana, and he pulled a gun out on me. It was a 380, completely different type of gun. And but he was close enough to me where I could, I was extremely frightened, but I felt like this guy was probably gonna kill me and cause me harm because he didn't look right. and I was able to wrestle it away from him, you know, and I fired him to the ground, and he ran off one direction, and I ran to my grandma's house as fast as I could. I don't even remember stopping at any point, and I ran to my room, and just I was drenched in sweat, and I ended up taking a bath and just kind of thinking through it, and you know, that's where I ended up getting it from.
Tim and Aaron both remember that Jonathan had a couple CDs with him, but neither of them recall him having a plastic bag, a portable CD player, or anything approaching a dozen CDs. And all three recall hanging out a bit and listening to Jonathan's music.
Yeah, and so if we start with Tim Russell and Aaron Windau, how close of friends are they?
At that time, we were cool. I went to school with them and hung out with them.
Jonathan still remembers the CD they played, and it certainly takes you back to 1997. So why is the CD important? Well, as noted, a CD case with 12 CDs was found outside the home of the burglary committed in the same neighborhood that same night. You'd think the police would have cataloged those 12 CDs, and if one of them was a Tupac album, then bam, you have your case. But no, there's no record, or at least no official record of those CDs being cataloged back in 1997, and no one knows where they are today. And that's important, because while these CDs could have proven Jonathan's guilt, they also could have proven his innocence if they weren't the type of CDs he was known to own or play. For instance, maybe one of the CDs was for a band that was popular back in my circles in 1997, but that likely wouldn't have been in Jonathan's collection. I'll tell you it's an easy thing when it's you and me. But don't when you eat my friend. That's the band Ween, and they're expressing a sentiment that led to my initial interest in this case. Don't where you eat. Imagine you're a young black man selling drugs in a mostly white neighborhood in a white flight suburb of St. Louis. On a night when you're making yourself very conspicuous by interacting with a bunch of people and selling drugs, on that same night, are you really going to burglarize one, and as we'll see, possibly two homes? Keep that in mind as we continue to track Jonathan's movements that night.
In his police statement, Larry Scarlett says that he saw Jonathan leave Tim Russell's place about 15 to 20 minutes after he entered and head west. If you head west from 1337 Buffalo Rock Road, you hit Wagon Wheel Trail, a north-south road. Head south for a block and you hit another east-west road on the Osage Meadows grid, Trading Post Lane. From there, if you turn east, you'll soon hit 1378 Trading Post Lane, which is where Amber and Crystal Beckman lived. Now, if you were a juror at Jonathan Irons' trial, you wouldn't have heard either sister's name. But Colin recently had a chance to talk with Crystal.
So how well did you know Jonathan back in 1997?
I mean, not too well. He was just kind of like, even though he didn't live in the neighborhood, he was out there a lot. Like, we hung out probably about 6 months before that happened.
Uh-huh.
I probably knew him. But not like every day or anything.
So the sisters were acquaintances of Jonathan, but not the type of close friends you might fear would fabricate an alibi for him. Crystal remembers Jonathan coming by a first time on the night of January 14th at about 5:15 p.m., which would generally line up with Larry Scarlett's statement on timing.
Mm-hmm. But I do remember him coming by. I do remember the first time, like, I think we were cooking dinner.
Specifically, in her police statement, Crystal said that her mom and her were cooking dinner when Jonathan first came to their front door. Crystal's mom answered the door and then came back and said Jay was asking to see Crystal and her sister, with Crystal then going to the door and seeing Jonathan walk away. Then, according to Crystal, Jonathan came back a second time.
And then I remember him coming back again, and I think we were eating, and then we used to have Bible study my dad would do a couple times a week. So I do remember him coming by a couple different times just to see if we can come outside, me and my sister, but we weren't able to, so.
In her police statement, Crystal places the second visit between 5:30 and 5:45 p.m. Also, at some point between 5:30 and 5:45 p.m., there's another witness who saw a young black male on Trading Post Lane, and she could be the key to solving this case, but she's not willing to talk. Her name is Christy Drullinger. According to Drellinger, between those times, a young black man rang her doorbell 3 times and banged on the glass outer door. Drellinger looked through the peephole and saw a young man who was nervous and out of breath, his eyes darting back and forth. She said that he was medium height, not short, but not tall. And she said this young man was wearing a ball cap and a hip-length jean jacket. Now recall, essentially all the other witnesses say that Jonathan Irons was wearing a hoodie and a dark jacket, not a baseball cap and jean jacket. Therefore, it seems quite possible that the person Drellinger saw was not Jonathan Irons, but instead the young man who committed the burglary.
For his part, Jonathan Irons says that the person who went to Christy Drellinger's house was definitely not him.
And there's another person named Christy Drellinger who says, I saw a young man with a jeans jacket who came by my place, and I'm guessing that's also probably this other person who might have committed the burglary. Is that right, or would you have talked to a Christy Drellinger?
Yeah, I don't even know who that person is or even why I would be over there. And I just, you know, I don't, that doesn't sound familiar to me at all.
The name Christy Drellinger also wouldn't sound familiar to the jurors in Jonathan Irons' case because she wasn't called at trial. The same goes for John O'Connor, who also lived on Trading Post Lane. O'Connor gave a police statement indicating that he was eating dinner at 5:45 p.m. that night when he heard a knock on the door and yelled out, "Come in." O'Connor was then shocked when it was a young black man who entered his house looking for his white son. And O'Connor told the young man that his son had moved out 9 months earlier. The young black man then said, "Okay," and left. Now, unlike Drellinger, O'Connor does say that the young man was wearing a hoodie and dark-colored pants, but he also says that the young man was about 5'7 to 5'8, while Irons was between 5'11 and 6 feet tall. So it's unclear who O'Connor would have been describing, and he has since said that he was never asked to make an identification. Again, for his part, Jonathan Irons says that this young man was not him.
Then there's another witness, John O'Connor, who says someone comes in looking to talk to his son. Do you think that was you or someone else who did that?
No. Yeah, that was someone else. I don't know any John O'Connor. You know, it doesn't ring a bell or any of that. I don't know who that person is.
So if Drellinger and or O'Connor were seeing someone else, where did Jonathan go after his second trip to the Beckman house? According to Jonathan, it was to get a drink that I actually was drinking back in 1997.
Mad Dog 2020. It brings friends together.
And in turn, that Mad Dog might explain the plastic bag that would later be used to tie Jonathan Irons to the crime scene.
And so, one of the big pieces of evidence at trial is this plastic bag that's found outside of Stanley Stotler's house. And my understanding is there are witnesses who see you with a plastic bag, but that's... My understanding is you had purchased, I think, some Mad Dog from the gas station, and that was where you got the plastic bag from. Is that correct?
Yeah, I walked to the gas station right down the street from the neighborhood. And, you know, I had a guy go in, and I was underage. I had a guy go in and buy it, and I brought it back. And I just wanted to, you know, hang out with my friends and, you know, imitate the Dalton and drink.
Mm-hmm.
Fleshing this out further, you'll recall that a plastic bag was found outside the broken window, which led into the burglarized house, and that the state would claim at trial that this was the same bag that Irons was using to lug around his CDs. But none of the witnesses who saw Jonathan Irons before 6 p.m. said that he had a plastic bag, and Timothy Russell specifically said that Jonathan just had a couple of CDs, and he wasn't carrying them around in anything.
But let's now move forward to 6 p.m. and the other witness the state called at trial, Scott Emberton, who lived at 1322 Shallow Lake Drive. Reorient ourselves in the Osage Meadows neighborhood, Shallow Lake Drive is the northernmost east-west street in the neighborhood, and also the closest to the Shell station where Irons would have gotten the Mad Dog. The next east-west street to the south is Buffalo Rock Drive, which is where Tim Russell and Aaron Window saw Jonathan Irons. And the next east-west street to the south is Trading Post Lane, which is where the Beckmans, Christy Drellinger, and John O'Connor lived. According to Scott Emberton, Jonathan Irons came to his house at 6 p.m. and asked Emberton to knock on the door of his neighbor, Jennifer Anderson, who who is Jonathan Irons' ex-girlfriend. And the reason for this Cyrano de Bergerac routine was that Anderson's parents did not approve of Jonathan Irons.
And then two other people who you see are Scott Emberton and Jennifer Anderson, who I think was your ex-girlfriend, is that right?
Yeah, at one point, yeah, she was my ex-girlfriend at one point, yeah.
And is my understanding correct that kind of her father wasn't your biggest fan, and so you got Scott to knock on her door to see if she would talk to you?
She had told me that her parents were, you know, were racist and, you know, didn't approve of, you know, us dating.
For the state's purpose, what's notable about the encounter with Scott Emberton is that Emberton said that Jonathan had a plastic bag with him, although he couldn't see what was in it. And while he at first said the plastic bag was brown, by the time of the trial he testified that the bag was white, which was the color of the bag found outside of the burglarized home. So let's go ahead and fast forward to that burglary, which is what the state did at trial. A man named Stanley Stotler arrived home at 1305 Shallow Lake Drive after work. We'll go into much more detail about the burglary in a later episode, but here are the basics. Stotler made his way to his bedroom, heard his closet door click, spoke to the burglar he correctly assumed was in the closet, and was shot by the burglar once. Tried to get the burglar to leave and was shot by the burglar a second time. Stotler would eventually make his way to the kitchen and call 911 to say he'd been shot by a young black man, with the call being logged in at 6:42 p.m. And responding officers noting the drawers of a chest in Stotler's house had been opened from top to bottom and the clothes were ransacked. Missouri residents have embraced the nickname the Show Me State, which describes them as skeptical citizens, unwilling to believe anything until you show them proof. But it would be tough for even the most skeptical juror to vote to acquit based on what they were shown at the Jonathan Irons trial. You have Jonathan Irons with a plastic bag on Shallow Lake Drive at 6 p.m. And then you have a young black man probably entering Stanley Stotler's home on the same block of Shallow Lake Drive at around 6:25 or 6:30 and shooting him at around 6:35 p.m., shortly before the 911 call. But there were other witnesses the jury didn't hear from. The first of those is a woman named Marge Zvara, who lived at 1341 Trading Post Lane, down the street from the Beckmans and two blocks south of Shallow Lake Drive, the site of the burglary. Zvara's memory in 2020 doesn't allow her to recall the events of 23 years ago, but here's the statement she gave on the night of the burglary.
About 6:25, I answered the door. A young black male, about 17 to 19 years old, asked me if Erica was home. The young man was wearing a black jacket and holding a tan plastic bag. He was about 5'10 to 6 feet tall, about 200 plus pounds. I guess when I told him Erica wasn't here, then he turned around and started to walk away. Then I asked him how old Erica was. He said 15 years old. I told him I thought he was talking about my niece. He then walked up the street. I have never seen him in this neighborhood before and have lived here for 12 years.
This statement describes Jonathan Irons' physical features to a T, and what Zvara says about his clothes matches what other witnesses had to say about what Jonathan was wearing. Her description of the tan plastic bag also syncs with Scott Emberton's initial description of a brown bag, which would not match the white plastic bag found outside Stanley Stotler's house.
Most importantly, though, Marge Zavara's house was smack dab in the middle of Trading Post Lane, with the lots in the neighborhood full of fences. If Marge Zavara really did see Jonathan Irons for about 5 minutes from 6:25 p.m. to 6:30 p.m., Irons would have needed to go east to White Hawk Drive and North South Street in Osage Meadows, and then two blocks to make it to Stotler's house. So does that make any sense? Let's work backwards. Stotler called 911 at 6:42 p.m. Before that, Stotler had spoken to the burglar, been shot, spoken to the burglar again, and been shot again. Before that, Stotler had entered his home and made his way to the back bedroom. And before that, the burglar had broken the basement window, climbed through the opening, made his way to Stotler's bedroom, and rummaged through the clothes and a dresser. Given all of that, what's the latest the burglar got to Stotler's place? Well, you'd have to think at least 15 to 20 minutes before the 911 call, which takes us back to 6:22 to 6:27 p.m. And if that's the case, there's no way that Jonathan Irons committed the burglary if he's the one who talked to Marge Zavara. And even if Zavara's time estimate is off by a few minutes in the wrong direction, Jonathan isn't leaving after the conversation until about 6:27 p.m., and he's still 2.5 blocks away from Stanley Stotler's place. So, was it Jonathan Irons who spoke with Marge Zavara?
There's a woman by the name of Marge Zavara who says a young man came to her place looking to talk to her niece. Was that you, or do you think that was someone else who knocked on her door?
It sounds like it was me. Because I think she had a relative, I believe, that I went to school with, and I thought she stayed there because she'd been in the house before. But I think she wasn't there. I was kind of confused about that. You know, when I asked, she said she wasn't there.
So, yeah, Jonathan has a memory of this interaction and a specific reason that he would have gone to Marge Zavara's house. Given this, it's pretty shocking that the defense never contacted Marge Zavara and never called her as a witness at trial. She was someone with no direct affiliation with Jonathan Irons, who could have provided him with a pretty solid alibi. Now, a show-me state skeptic might say that Zavara places Irons relatively close to the Stotler residence around the time of the burglary, but Scott Amberton already placed Irons on the same block as the Stotler residence at 6 p.m., while Zavara would have placed him 2.5 blocks away at around the same time or even after the time that he would have needed to break into the basement window at the Stotler residence. But Zavara was not the only potential alibi witness. There were also the Beckman sisters. You'll recall that Crystal said that Jonathan came by once while she was cooking dinner and once while her family was eating dinner. Well, back in 1997, both Beckman sisters said that there was also a third time that Jonathan stopped by, during family Bible study. Either the night of the burglary or the next morning, Crystal's sister Amber, who is now deceased, gave a police statement. And according to Amber, she answered the door this third time and told Jonathan that she couldn't come outside. In the statement, you can tell that Amber initially wrote that Jonathan had come over at 6:30 p.m., but then she wrote a 4 over the 3 to make the time 6:40 p.m. But whether it was 6:30 or 6:40 p.m., this encounter strengthens Jonathan's alibi.
And then, as you mentioned, there's Amber and Crystal Beckman, and both of them say you came to their place 3 times that night, and they were doing Bible study or making dinner. But were they close friends too?
Yeah. They were close friends. I won't say close like best friends, but close mm-hmm. enough where, you know, we hung out together. You know.
And do you remember? So, I mean, that's
all the same people.
Yeah, they both say you came sort of 3 different times that night to their place. Do you remember being really eager to see them or having a reason to really want to see them that night?
Yeah, we just wanted to hang out. You know, they wanted to come out, but you know, it didn't happen. It couldn't happen because they had things coming up. They had Bible study.
As noted, both the Beckmans and Marge Zavara lived on Trading Post Lane, 2 blocks south of the Stotler residence. And Amber's statement seems to logically have Jonathan going from the Zavara's place after their 6:25 talk to the Beckman residence between 6:30 and 6:40 p.m. This, of course, would make it impossible that Jonathan Irons could have been the burglar breaking into the Stotler residence about 15 to 20 minutes before the 911 call at 6:42 p.m., especially because the Beckman residence is farther from Stotler's residence than Zavara's house. Now, in fairness, there are a couple complications with Amber's statement. First, she said she saw Jonathan Irons with a white plastic bag, which is the same color plastic bag found outside the Stotler residence. And second, Crystal places this third trip a bit earlier, between 6:15 and 6:30 p.m. I recently asked Crystal about the disparate but similar times given by her sister and her. And in terms of that third time when he came by and you were doing Bible study, do you remember back then when you used to do Bible study?
I mean, it was different. It was typically in the evening after dinner, but I mean, sometimes it could be 6, sometimes 6:30. Normally I'd say between 5:30 and 6:30. Just to be precise, though, I mean, I would have to read them. I feel like I was really close on time what we wrote. Because since he had came 3 different times,
uh-huh.
like, we pretty much, you know, had our schedule. Like, we got out of school, we did our homework, we did our chores. you know, stuff like that. So,
and then the third time, I have a couple. I think you said between 6:15 and 6:30, and your sister, I think, said 6:40 p.m. was when he came back and you were having Bible study.
Okay, yeah. That, it could last 30 minutes to an hour. It's just something my dad did. You know, uh-huh. It wasn't like if someone came over. It wasn't like a preacher was coming over and we had it at the exact, like, it lasted an hour each time.
Right.
But typically, it was 30 minutes to an hour.
So you could break this down a few ways. First, maybe Amber, the sister who actually answered the door, was more accurate on time, and her estimate of 6:30 to 6:40 p.m. is more reliable. Second, maybe Amber's initial time of around 6:30 was correct, which falls at the back end of Crystal's estimate, and still places Jonathan's trip to their house after his trip to Marge Zavara's house. Both of these theories seem to make sense based on the layout of the Osage Meadows grid. As noted, Scott Emberton and Jennifer Anderson placed Jonathan Irons on Shallow Lake Drive between about 6 and 6:15 p.m. Both of their houses are to the east of Shallow Lake Drive and just a few doors down from White Hawk Drive. Meanwhile, as noted, Marge Zavara's house is smack dab in the middle of Trading Post Lane, two blocks to the south. On the other hand, the Beckman residence is the farthest house to the west on Trading Post Lane, on the corner of that street and Wagon Wheel Trail. So A, the route to Zavara's house was a lot more direct. B, going to the Beckman residence first required doubling back to Zavara's house. And C, it's not entirely clear that Jonathan Irons could have gotten from Jennifer Anderson's house to the Beckman residence and then to Zavara's house by 6:25 p.m. And so, if Jonathan did talk to Amber Beckman for a few minutes after arriving sometime between 6:30 and 6:40 p.m., there's of course no way he could have burglarized Stotler's house, given that the burglar would have needed to arrive at the house between 6:22 and 6:27 at the latest.
Moreover, let's assume any scenario in which Jonathan went to the Beckman residence after going to Zavara's house. Would he have had enough time to make it to Stotler's place in time to commit the burglary? Jonathan had a private investigator, Monty Franklin, time it.
Part of the work you did in the case was to walk from one residence in O'Fallon, the Beckman residence, to the residence of the victim, Stanley Stotler?
Yes.
And so what was the theory you were trying to test there?
Well, Jonathan had me do that. He wanted me to record the time it took to walk from one place to the other. In a normal walk, in a normal gait. And I did that, and it took exactly 8 minutes. The address is on, the route was on like a horseshoe or a U-shaped walk I took.
So no, the timing doesn't work. Even if Jonathan started talking to Amber at 6:15 or 6:20 instead of 6:30 or 6:40, he's not making it to the Stotler's house in time. In other words, even if the front end of Crystal's time estimate for Jonathan's third trip to the Beckman residence is the most accurate, there's virtually no way Jonathan could have committed the crime. Of course, you might speculate that defense counsel must have talked with the Beckmans and for whatever reason concluded that their Bible study alibi was lacking. But if you did, you would be wrong.
And I know you've spoken to some people more recently, but back in 1997, 1998, was it just that one time you spoke to police and then you were never contacted again by the police or his defense counsel?
Yeah, never. I remember seeing one of his cousins or something out, and they were like, yeah, Johnny wanted to know why you and your sister didn't come to court or didn't testify or something. And I said, what? I said, you can't just not go to court if I would know if I had a court case.
Right.
You know, they never contacted us. And I don't even know at that point when I did hear this, like, my sister passed in 2001, so I don't even remember if this was before she passed or after. But no, they never got, we lived at the same house until right before 2001. In 2000, we moved. So, I mean, we had the same address, same phone number. You know, everything, it wouldn't have been hard to get in touch with us. But no, we never heard anything.
Finally, even if you doubt the exact timing and order of Jonathan's trips to Marge Zavara's house and the Beckman residence, the mere fact that they occurred is important as well. Why? Well, there was a second burglary in Osage Meadows that night, and it was not interrupted. At 7:02 p.m., a police officer was dispatched from the scene of the Stotler burglary to another home in Osage Meadows that had been burglarized. The point of entry was the same for both houses, a broken northeast basement window. The second victim said that he found his home burglarized upon arriving home and showed the officers footprints that were still in the snow on his patio, along with a broken wood frame gate. It seems pretty clear that the same person committed both burglaries, and it also seems clear that this other burglary occurred first. After all, A, there wouldn't be enough time to commit the other burglary after the Stotler burglary, and B, it's unlikely the burglar would stick around to commit a second burglary after a first botched burglary that ended up in a shooting. On the other hand, there were still snow shoe prints outside the second home, suggesting that the other burglary was relatively recent. And if that's the case, how could Jonathan Irons have committed this other burglary in the 6 o'clock hour? After all, he's seen by Scott Emberton, Jennifer Anderson, Amber Beckman, and Marge Zavara all in the first 25 to 40 minutes of that hour. Simply put, there's no time for Jonathan Irons to commit the second burglary.
And so, plastic bag aside, there seems to be all the reason in the world to call Amber Beckman as an alibi witness. And about that bag, well, there's one final witness that the jury didn't hear from at trial. His name was Chris White, and he was 12 years old back in 1997, and he lived on Shallow Lake Drive. According to Chris White, he saw Jonathan Irons on January 14th at about 7 p.m. White says that Irons was walking down the street and asked if his brothers were home, leading to a conversation between the two of them. Notably, Chris White did not see Jonathan Irons with a gun, but he says that Jonathan had a bag. Actually, two bags. One was a brown plastic bag, and one was a rolled-up brown paper bag. This is important for three reasons. First, like a few other witnesses, Chris White saw Jonathan Irons with a brown or tan plastic bag rather than the white plastic bag seen outside Stoller's house. Second, and more importantly, Chris White saw Jonathan Irons about 20 to 30 minutes after the burglary, still holding the plastic bag. Assuming this is the same plastic bag that Jonathan had earlier, then Jonathan wasn't the one who dropped a plastic bag outside Stotler's house. After all, he still had his plastic bag. Third, Chris White saw Jonathan Irons with both the plastic bag and a rolled-up brown paper bag. This would completely corroborate Jonathan's claim that he had someone purchase a Mad Dog for him in a paper bag inside a plastic bag, and that his plastic bag was not for carrying his CDs. So, what does Jonathan Irons have to say about Chris White?
Yeah, what I find interesting then is there's this witness, Chris White. Did you know Chris White?
I believe I knew his brother, and he sounds familiar.
Okay, he was 12 years old at the time, and he says, I saw Jonathan Irons with a plastic bag at about 7 o'clock, which seems to me, I'm still trying to track him down, but it seems really important because he's saying, I saw you with this plastic bag, which would have been, you know, 20, 25 minutes after this burglary where the plastic bag was left at the scene of the crime.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember going by there, but... And he really didn't say much. And we just kind of like nodded at him. And I think he was sitting outside, doing something. I could get nobody to hang out and come out. And I was kind of like, man, this is boring. I gotta figure out I gotta figure out something to do, somewhere to go. And I called my friend to come get me, and I was basically waiting on him.
So, yeah, it makes complete sense that Jonathan Irons would have started a conversation with Chris White about whether his brothers were home. But you know what doesn't make sense? Jonathan Irons being caught by Stanley Stotler during a botched burglary, shooting him twice, and then strolling down Shallow Lake Drive and striking up a conversation with one of his residents. If Jonathan Irons really had shot Stotler, you'd think he would have made himself scarce as soon as possible, rather than sticking around and striking up a conversation.
Instead, what seems likely is there are at least two young black men in Osage Meadows that night. Jonathan Irons, who everyone said was cool, calm, and collected, and the other young man seen by Christy Drullinger between 5:30 and 5:45 p.m., who is nervous and out of breath, his eyes darting back and forth. You could easily see that young man being on the brink of committing two burglaries, or being in between burglaries and looking for a second house to hit. Or maybe the burglar was someone else entirely. So what did Stanley Stotler, the victim of one of the burglaries, have to say about the man who shot him? Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. As always, I'd like to thank our sponsors. You can support us at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.